Hey, folks, you've arrived. This is The Takeaway for June 23rd, 2015. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And the president chooses this outlandish, entertaining, honest, obscure outpost of the First Amendment to make some pretty important statements about racism. Did you notice? On the streaming interview program WTF, a popular podcast, Barack Obama talked about racism, alive and well in America, with WTF host Mark Maron.
The legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, discrimination in almost every institution of our lives, you know, that casts a long shadow. And that's still part of our DNA. That's passed on. We're not cured of it.
This hour, how the online world is a window on a lot of America we might prefer not to look at, as well as something that drives institutions like higher education and the changing music business. Warning, Taylor Swift music later this hour. But we begin by playing out what the president means by the DNA of racism and where it can be found replicating itself in the wake of the Charleston shootings. What the president is talking about is hardly a surprise. Instead of DNA, the president could just have easily spoken about specific groups dedicated to white supremacy that exist today, that go back more than a century, that have been active in mainstream American politics and still are. This week, The Guardian reported Earl Holt III, the leader of a white supremacist group, donated thousands of dollars to a number of current Republican presidential campaigns. Holt's group, the Pro-Segregationist Council of Conservative Citizens, apparently influenced Dylan Roth, the Charleston shooter. Joining us is Joe Crespino, author of Strom Thurmond's America and In Search of Another Country, Mississippi and the Conservative Counter-Revolution. He's also a professor of history at Emory University.
The history of white supremacist groups in American politics is deeply rooted. One of the places to begin in thinking about it is with the important role, say, that the Ku Klux Klan played in the 1920s. It started during the Reconstruction period, but it revived in the 1920s and was popular in many areas, not just in the South. It was a stronghold in Indiana. They were a force to be reckoned with in Detroit politics. And a number of high-profile politicians had ties to the Klan. Hugo Black, the liberal Supreme Court justice, had been a member in Alabama in the 1920s, as well as Robert Byrd, the senator from West Virginia. So, you know, there's a long history of this kind of connections between white supremacist groups and mainstream politicians.
And if we were to have a conversation about whether a member of Congress was, you know, recruited by ISIS or the mayor of Detroit had something to do with al-Qaeda, it would be such an explosive conversation, it wouldn't even last very long. But we never have this conversation about the KKK and where these kinds of groups are in relationship to American politics, but they're certainly much closer than ISIS or al-Qaeda.
Yeah, it's striking, really. And people who come from the outside, people who are not familiar with American history, I think are really shocked to see how prominent the symbols of the Confederacy remain in our public life today. I had friends visiting from Germany last week, and we went out to Stone Mountain of Georgia to see the Confederate memorials that are there. It's really remarkable how much that is a part and how much that gives a kind of sanctuary for certain extremist groups in our politics today.
And the German experience of dealing with extremism post the Nazi era is essentially to kind of cleanse society of all these messages in a very, very active way. And that's something that, for a variety of reasons, we didn't do in the United States.
No, we haven't done it. And it's striking to go to Germany and see how differently they handled their very troubled history compared to the way that we think about our own history of white supremacy in the United States. It's really a striking difference.
When Barack Obama says it's still a part of our DNA that's passed on, is he talking about some impression, some, you know, prejudice, or is he talking about, or do you hear him talking about a whole organized movement of white supremacist and white power groups that began with the beginning of the United States?
Well, it's certainly true that, you know, throughout the 18th and 19th century, white supremacy was the mainline position in American politics. To be for racial equality puts you in a vast minority in American politics. You were radicals. You were far, far outside the mainstream. And so The whole idea of it being an advocate for social equality and racial equality is a artifact of the 20th century. So it's important to remember that historically, the issues that we are dealing with, while they seem ancient, are really quite new, relatively new in the broader sweep of American history. So to say that it's in our DNA is a way of saying that it's deeply rooted in our history, and it remains close to the surface and something that this country has not fully reckoned with in our public life.
And it's not unexpected that Barack Obama would speak like an academic to say it's a part of our DNA that's passed on. Maybe a better way of describing it is that while you would have to maybe work pretty hard to find a way into a website for ISIS and Al-Qaeda, to get the message of race war in the U.S. requires almost no effort at all. A Dylan Roth could absorb this message by simply walking down the street of where he grew up.
Well, it's true, and the internet has certainly, you know, expanded the ability of groups to communicate and to form communities around some pretty toxic ideas. But it's also true, John, that these ideas, you can draw a line from where we are today back into our relatively recent and not so recent past and see how, you know, white supremacist groups have played a consistent role in our politics. You know, I talked about the Klan earlier, but, you know, that their role continued throughout the 1930s, 40s, and 50s, where they had clear ties to the Southern Democratic Party. And then, you know, a lot of this changes in the 1960s as partisan politics begin to change. And groups that are explicitly white supremacists find common cause with other kinds of conservative groups or anti-government. And they find a kind of safe haven there, and they find a lot of, you know, sympathetic support there with various anti-government groups that are emerging. But, you know, there are groups that still exist to this day that have their roots in groups that played a larger role in mainstream politics in decades past, but that still exist today and that still spew their hatred in ways that are repugnant.
Joe Crespino is author of Strom Thurmond's America and In Search of Another Country, Mississippi and the Conservative Counter-Revolution. He's also a professor of history at Emory University. Joe, thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
In the New Yorker magazine this week, writer Jelani Cobb comments on the Charleston shooting by connecting a history of racism in the U.S. with active white supremacist groups and concludes that whether Dylan Roth acted by himself, he was not alone. Roth was active on many of the websites and hate communities online that talk continually about white people being under siege, being taken over by blacks, that accuse Barack Obama of leading a black army of world government against whites, among other provocative claims. Adam G. Klein is author of A Space for Hate, The White Power Movement's Adaptation into Cyberspace. He's assistant professor in communication studies at Pace University here in New York. Klein says the way the internet experience has deepened in the last two decades, there really are no such thing as loners in this world of imaginary race wars.
People like Dylan Roth have found an accessibility to these communities that they never would have found in the outside world. Online, everything seems a lot more normal. There's more of a political community, and there's a social network about it. So for someone like Dylan, anybody that has a racist inclination beforehand, they have a way to go online and feel as if this is a social experience. They go into these forums. The one I think he talked about being enlightened by was the Council of Conservative Citizens, mm-hmm. where there is, you know, there's news, there's politics, there's chat rooms. But then beneath that is the subtext, the themes of, in his case, black on white crime, a lot of alarmist rhetoric and things that he can indulge in.
Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber, bounced around between militia groups where yep. he actually had an active presence and certain online sorts of groups that he participated in before he made his way to the Murrah Building and mm-hmm. committed, you know, the worst act of terrorism, at least in that kind of bombing
right.
In U.S. history. And again, you know, we're rethinking terrorism because of the racial incidents that we're looking at back through U.S. history. Is his trajectory similar to Roth's in any way?
In some ways, I mean, you could look at – he was inspired by – I think the book was The Turner Diaries,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, sure.
And that's a book about racial holy war
yeah.
that starts off with a sci-fi book in a way, but guys that are blowing up a federal building with fertilizer bomb material. And
a book you can buy today.
Yeah, yeah, a popular book. And so it's media at the end of the day. It's hard to – anytime you say, well, look, it's the fault of the internet. It's the fault of this author. But at the same time, when you look at someone like Dylan this week, he's inspired by a community. His manifesto reads as if he wants to become a hero to that community. So it forces you to look at this trajectory and to see, well, if he's trying to live up to something, was it there beforehand? Was it being kind of massaged and you know, what's between the lines of a website like the CCC website or Stormfront that on the surface looks – that doesn't look harmless, but it does look – there's no swastikas anymore. There's no burning crosses on these websites. They've done away with that.
They've got their First Amendment business in order. I mean, they're protected speech.
Sure.
But I'm wondering if there's a distinction that can be made, and do federal investigators make it, between active – recruitment for a militia army where people can go and, you know, camp out over the weekend,
right?
Which was the case of the Aryan Nation in the old days and still exists now, but a different kind of recruiting, passive recruiting, where there's this place you can go online that suggests all kinds of options, and that all of a sudden it occurs to Dylan Roth to say, no one's doing anything but talking on the internet. Someone has to have the bravery to take it to the real world. I guess that has to be me. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of no different, passive recruiting versus active recruiting.
I think it's worse. I mean, passive recruiting gives you this feeling like it's okay, that if you're, you know, if you're looking from it from the point of view of law enforcement, their job is in some ways harder. Because, you know, how do they distinguish what would be fighting words, form of hate speech from 100 different news stories about black on white crime that I think are much more effective if you're someone who's feeding into this and looking for, you know, that excuse, that reason to, you know, validate your racism. You're going to see, well, that's a news story that came from – that actually happened, as opposed to something that's a lot more – obvious hate speech.
Is it your impression that the internet gives these people more of a sense that there are no borders, that they're basically a white tribe fighting a war against non-whites?
Yes. I think that they have a sense of anonymity for one thing. You know, everybody I think is a different version of themselves online to some degree in how daring they are and how they communicate. But for someone with a racist inclination, that gives them what they've been seeking, and they can have that anonymity factor to protect them. However, I think that there's the other side of the spectrum in terms of law enforcement is there is a positive. They could also see more than they were never able to see before. We can put more, I think, of a finger on what we suspect is bubbling beneath the surface of society sometimes when we can see it in these websites. We could read these forums and sometimes for every, you know, Dylan Roth, there's been numerous cases, I think, of somebody putting something on Facebook that we've been able to stop before it happens.
Adam Klein is author of A Space for Hate, The White Power Movement's Adaptation into Cyberspace. He's assistant professor in communication studies at Pace University here in New York. Adam, thanks.
Thank you.
Get into Harvard University, MIT? Forget it. That's hard. You can't just show up and expect to be admitted. Toughest schools in the world. You'd have to sneak in.
Let's just start with a very basic fact, which is that all of us and all of our food is made of molecules.
That's science and cooking, from haute cuisine to soft matter science. It's a Harvard course. If you want something meatier, MIT's got Making Science and Engineering Pictures.
So using this scanner can, if you choose, come close to imaging
so
with a
today
microscope.
Today we focus all the more sure on the arts of programming. And we take where we left off last week, focusing on...
Because Back to the Future is an excellent example of an inconsistent time travel story.
But this chorus of academia requires no sneak attack to experience. It's just a keystroke away in the three-year-old EDX Online Massive Open Online Course, or MOOC, collaboration between the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and Harvard. Off-campus online and free, it turns out, is the new on-campus for 4 years and very expensive. MOOCs are among the most disruptive and exciting developments in higher education, attracting students and scaring academics all over the world. And this month, The Takeaway got the privilege of sitting down with the presidents of Harvard and MIT, Drew Faust and Raphael Reif, to discuss how this online experiment is going. President Reif of MIT says he understands fully the power of being able to experience this level of learning growing up far from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
When I was a student myself in college in South America, in Venezuela, and I was studying from MIT textbooks, and to me, just touching an MIT textbook was the most amazing thing in the world. It's just, I was not just learning from my professor in class, I was just learning from MIT. It would have been a dream, an imaginable dream back then, to think that I would not just be touching the textbook, I would actually be seeing the professor and learning from the professor directly. And not only that, just studying with thousands of people at the same time from all over the world, the same material. I mean, that is, just to think of that and to think how all that has happened just in the last few years is a tremendous dream come true for many, many people worldwide.
What Rafael is describing, of course, is what you particularly, President Faust, have discovered as you travel around the world. President Faust?
One of the most moving aspects of this for me came quite early on in the experiment, because we launched into edX very soon after I'd been traveling in India. And during that trip in India, I had been approached by many people about the public health knowledge that our School of Public Health generates and shares with the world. Huge appetite in India, which is very challenged in these realms, to learn more about public health. And so I was busily thinking about how we could have more partnerships and bring more people to Harvard and bring more Harvard faculty to India. And then that fall, a course launched, a kind of basic building block of public health, biostatistics and epidemiology, taught by two veteran faculty at our School of Public Health. 8,000 people in India alone took that course. And so there in an eye blink, those two faculty taught more individuals than they had in their entire careers up to that time. Those individuals taking the course in India wanted to see each other. And so they figured out ways to come together, a kind of flash mob where the people taking it in Mumbai said, let's all get together and meet and talk and share the course live and at the same time as we take it online from Harvard.
When students come up to you, Drew Faust and Rafael Reif, and claim that, hey, I'm part of the Harvard family or I'm part of the MIT family, does that demean the value of the credential or enhance the value of the credential? Because some educators might say, hey, a four-year education at Harvard is not the same as going online for a few courses. Drew Faust?
It isn't the same, but at a time when education is the currency of the 21st century, it's the source of human dignity, of social mobility, of the future of the planet, the opportunity to share this more broadly with people all around the world is, I believe, an imperative. And so I welcome that sense that we have succeeded in touching people a world away, and I welcome them as part of an expanded Harvard family.
Well, one game here is that you can get an education without paying the kinds of prices that it costs for tuition at places like Harvard and MIT. Does this solve the problem of the high cost of tuition? Is there a monetary stream in these online courses? And what about schools that aren't as notable as Harvard and MIT? Do they have an opportunity here, or are they going to just get diluted?
Well, so far, we have invested a great deal more in creating these courses than we have generated in any way from them. We recognize that we have to figure out sustainable business models that can provide resources for the production values and for the engagement of faculty and others. Also, what are the models of credit giving, and how do we think about that? And how is a course like this different or the same as a course that is offered in a live format? So there's a lot of experimentation going on. I think ultimately what we need to sort through is how to figure out ways that we can develop hybrid models that can help us reduce the cost of residential education, so that as we think about our on-campus realities in the future, what are human beings live uniquely suited to do, and what can we rely on other modes to deliver?
Could you two comment on how democratizing this is for education across the world, if in fact it is as successful as you envision?
I think democratizing is really a wonderful world for what we're trying to do here. So just imagine a situation in which not only those who get admitted get to learn from Harvard professors and MIT professors, but everybody who is willing to try. And everybody all of a sudden gets empowered by knowing from a little town in Malaysia or a little, you know, village in Venezuela, they are studying with 10 or 50,000 more people globally, and they are realizing they are learning and they are as good as others are just by applying themselves.
President Faust?
I want to make sure that given the kinds of special, very special opportunities inherent in residential education, that we don't use the reality of online education to say, oh, well, that's just good enough for a substantial portion of the world, and give up on trying to reach out, as both our institutions have so significantly, in bringing people from around the world and from every economic circumstance into our campuses as residential students. The online possibilities do have enormous potential, and I believe in them deeply. But I don't want to stop with that when I think about how we can expand educational opportunity.
Drew Faust and Raphael Reif, thank you so much for being a part of the program.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us, John.
Drew Faust is the president of Harvard University, and Raphael Reif is president of MIT. Those schools together launched the experiment EDX, a massive open online course, or MOOC. Here's a power list for you. Motorola, IBM, Samsung, Nokia, the Department of Justice, Amazon, Microsoft, the Beatles, Carl Sagan, the European Union, Kodak, AT&T, Cisco Systems, Hewlett-Packard, and the City of New York. They've all sued or been sued by Apple. And they all have to stand in line behind 25-year-old pop star Taylor Swift for demonstrating more clout with Apple than all of the above. In just a few hours this week, with a single blog and a single threat to keep her new music off of the new Apple streaming service if Apple doesn't pay artists during its trial subscription period, she made Apple back down by posting this open letter to Tumblr titled, "To Apple, Love Taylor." She writes, "We don't ask you for free iPhones. Please don't ask us to provide you with our music for no compensation." Kind of like, what would you rather listen to? Taylor? So take a look what you've done. Or Tim Cook of Apple?
Today we're announcing Apple Music, the next chapter in music, and I know you are going to love it.
Kind of a no-brainer, although the director of this program would say neither. He tries to make this a Taylor-free zone. But this is the 21st century, where we can watch a almost billionaire with a billionaire of pop culture battling it out. And other billionaires and would-be billionaires are on the sidelines, watching how this turns out. A generation after Napster, this is yet another battle between technology, musicians, and consumers who want what they want. Jeff Price is CEO of Audium, a music licensing company that focuses specifically on streaming services. It's a whole new world, he says.
Taylor Swift was able to bring into the forefront a inside baseball issue that was happening. It's been happening for over 10 years, actually, the free trial subscriptions. The digital streaming services that are coming up, Rhapsody is an example, Spotify is another, and the forthcoming Apple Music service, they're all trying to figure out what the right model is. But more importantly, these are technology companies using music in order to make money, and they can lose money on the music in order for them to make money. For example, Spotify is worth over $8 billion.
Right.
That's with a B. They've raised about $1 billion in private equity and venture capital, but they lose money on music every single day. For them, it's about a return on investment, right? So what they're doing is they're putting together a model where they can get market share. And along the way, they're just throwing together a business model. And the business models they're throwing together appear at the moment to be working to their advantage, but simultaneously not to the advantage of the artist or musician, label, or copyright holder. The Apple transition is extremely important because what they have on file is over 800 million credit cards from people around the world. They've got basically every piece of recorded music in existence on their servers. So frankly, at the click of a button, it is possible for Apple to migrate the entire population of music listeners from downloads into streams. And with that comes a significant seismic change. The question is, will the financial model work? Up to this point in time, the major record labels have done deals with the Rhapsodies and Spotifys where they said, go ahead and do these trial subscriptions where people can try your product, not pay you. And when that music streams, you don't have to pay us. We're going to make it free. We're going to pick up your cost of customer acquisition, which is insane as far as I'm concerned. So Apple was merely doing what everyone else had done before. But there was a bit of a problem because of its size, because of its impact, because Apple is also simultaneously the place where people go to buy download music. if everyone's flipped from downloads to streams that quickly, it would cannibalize the income for everybody. Look at it this way.
But wait, hold on one second, though. The one thing that is bizarre to me is this was the generation, the Taylor Swift generation, post-Napster, that was supposed to get music for free. This was supposed to be the generation that never would pay for a download. And not only are they paying for downloads, but slowly they're becoming subscribers to these streaming services, and we're gradually evolving back to a kind of radio model.
We are. And what has to happen, in my opinion, is consumers need to pay for music but not feel like they're paying for music. People today have moved into a model where they can get all music whenever they want, what feels like for free. YouTube's a perfect example, right? YouTube, with your eyes closed, is Spotify, basically.
Right.
So if you're dealing with what do consumers want and how do we give it to them while simultaneously trying to create an economic model that works for both the music service and the copyright holders. And finding that right blend is going to be difficult. But when we do, when we create something of excellence, everybody wins. One of the ways I think you're able to do that is instead of positioning things as, hey, pay $10 a month for access to 31 million songs, of which 99% you'll never listen to, through these on-demand streams that you can do on your smartphones, turn it into a lifestyle product. Hey, for $10, $15 a month, you can have curated playlists where you tell us you're doing a barbecue, we'll give you 12 songs you can play.
Which is exactly the way my 16-year-olds
do
it. They love that. And they absolutely love it. And of course, I'm paying for it, but eventually they would pay for this kind of thing. And the thing that's mind-boggling to me is that in the old days, radio had the power. Radio said, we don't play your records, you got nothing. Taylor Swift has suddenly inverted this gigantic pyramid and said, we're not on your streaming service, my band, my record, you're dead. And that's a huge inversion, it seems to me.
It is. Well, a couple things. This sort of issue of these free trial subscriptions, this has been going on for 10 years. It's just no one's talked about it. What Taylor Swift was able to do based on her popularity is bring a inside baseball topic into the public foray. Had Apple launched its service in 9 to 8 days now, I think, and said from the inception, we're going to pay for free trial subscriptions, everyone would have applauded and said, that's great, but that would have come and gone very quickly. Because this went down the way it did, and nobody scripted it, it just worked out this way. What we have is Apple getting a second wave of publicity that they never anticipated. Simultaneously, it makes it look like they have a soul, right? There's a human being that responded to an outcry from an artist.
Aww.
You know, right? Exactly, right?
Yeah.
And you know, you're right. So now they look like the good guy. And you know what? They kind of are in this case. I think they just screwed up. And as a man that ran a record label myself, I'll tell you, if I had to go 90 days without being able to sell the thing that I sell and still had to stay in business, I would have gone out of business. I don't think they thought about that.
It's a chaotic, huge, converging mess out there anyway, which is exactly where you have the most fun, right?
Yeah, well, it actually is a lot of fun. I mean, what's weird is there's never been more money being generated off of music than there is today, but less of it is getting into the pockets of the rights holders and artists. And that's what we need to fix, and we need to fix it now, particularly when Apple is possibly going to change the entire global music listening market. We need that right financial model.
Jeff Price is CEO of Audium, a music licensing company that focuses specifically on streaming services, like the ones we were just talking about. Jeff, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
So what do you think? Does Taylor's victory over Apple make Ms. Swift the queen of the music industry? Does anyone even pay for music anymore? Suzette writes on Facebook, I do stream KCSM 91.9, and I'm a sustaining member, but otherwise I still buy CDs and vinyl. Shavat from Austin, Texas writes, we all pay for the music we listen to. If we buy albums, CDs, downloads, attend live music, or if we listen to commercial radio, we pay with having to sit through commercials, of which many products advertised are purchased by us or by others. Yeah, we get the advertising model. The issue is not do we pay for the music we listen to. The issue is Apple's sense of entitlement. Apple makes great products, and they have proved that they are narcissistic when they think of others' rights to set their own fee and expect to get it. So smart of Apple to sing Ms. Swift's song after she had to teach them the tune. Nice. 8778-MY-TAKE is our number. You can join the conversation on Facebook at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Those 9 aging justices on the U.S. Supreme Court. One can only guess what they were taught about homosexuality as children. But when these 6 men and 3 women make a decision on same-sex marriage this term, they will be putting the period at the end of a long narrative of cultural change that began before any of them were born. The love story between 2 young men named Jack Baker and Michael McConnell comes somewhere in the middle of that narrative. The year was 1970. And at the time, the 2 smitten University of Minnesota students wanted to get married, but had never known another married gay couple. So they just went down to Hennepin County District Court. and became the first known same-sex couple in the U.S. to apply for a marriage license. The two are still together, and besides making a home together, being in love, and making a life for themselves, they were making history. Michael says it was one of those love-at-first-sight kind of things, or you might say history-at-first-sight.
As our friend Cruz, who introduced us 48 years ago, said, you two are destined for each other. At the time, I wasn't really sure that that was true, but the truth is, he was right. And so I kind of feel like we've arrived at a very, very comfortable, loving, committed relationship that we can be proud of.
Do you think of yourself as activists?
When you speak of activist, that has many meanings to me. In the 70s, we were highly visible, highly public, and very, very active. After the 80s, I began to focus on my career, and he began to do his law practice and engineering privately. But that doesn't mean that we dropped out of the, quote, active scene. We worked behind the scenes with many others. For example, during the AIDS crisis in the 80s locally, and we still from time to time spoke. I did things in my own profession, in the library profession, with regard to subject headings about GLBT people and getting those changed so that they were not negative and hateful. I worked with a number of librarians across the country. So many of the things that we did, you wouldn't see, but they would have long-term impact and create change in ways that people wouldn't necessarily see big time, but would rather experience in their lives.
How did you get that marriage license? What was the actual circumstance?
I did some research after I was a second-year law student, and what you learn in law school is that everyone's entitled to equal protection under the law. And when I read the statute, nowhere in Minnesota statute did it say that two men could not marry each other. And under the rule of law, what's not forbidden is permitted. But when we applied in Hennepin County, the clerk said that he would not issue the license. We decided that the alternative to that would be an adoption, and you can get almost as many benefits of marriage as an adoption. And so we went to the court and applied for an adoption where Michael adopted me. And in that process, you are entitled to a name change. And so we just routinely did a name change. And once the court issued the adoption certificate with the name change, we simply went down to another county and applied for a license, which was issued. And everything was done according to law, and no one has challenged it. It has never been taken to a court, and it is a lawful license, a lawful contract, and only a court can invalidate a lawful contract. And so it has remained legal to this day. And once we had the certificate, that we had a Methodist minister agreed to perform the ceremony and sign the contract and validate it and then submit the documentation back to the clerk of court.
What was more important to you, looking back now, the paperwork that certified this relationship as a valid marriage, or the ceremony and the celebration that indicates that the community is with you as a couple?
For me personally, it is that personal commitment. As my parents told me when I was growing up, you are as good as anyone else. And I took that to heart, and I believe that. And if all my brothers and sisters could have marriages, and my cousins and others in my family could have marriages, I believed I should be able to have a marriage. And to celebrate that in the family and with friends was extremely important. I wanted that same feeling of security and love that others in my family experienced. Certainly, it's important to have the contract, because in our society, rights and privileges are distributed through the marriage contract. I'm entitled to those same marriage privileges and rights as any other citizen, and I wasn't about to take less.
You've spent how many years together?
We were married on September 3rd, 1971. We committed on March 10th, 1967. So we've been together since 1967, 48 years. We're now going into our 49th year.
So we have all together lived to a moment where I can ask you a question that wouldn't have made sense maybe 3 decades ago. What's your secret? And I'm not asking you what's your secret as a gay couple or as a straight couple. I'm just asking you, what's your secret?
Well, I committed and I live up to my commitments. And the most important thing is I love him.
And for me, it was that the usual term that people do use is love at first sight. It falls closely into that category. But once I saw Michael, I decided that I would make a commitment, and it turned out I was right. So,
you know, I just have to say, you know, love is the most powerful force in the universe. Same-sex bonds like ours are a basic ingredient of human life. And our relationship, like all relationships, is about love and commitment. And when we made those vows, we believed it. And we still do.
Michael McConnell and Jack Baker, thanks for sharing your secrets. And the best of luck to you. And what a history you've lived.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Michael McConnell and Jack Baker are the first same-sex couple in the U.S. to apply for a marriage license. That was back in 1970. Their story, as told to Gail Karwoski, will be published by the University of Minnesota Press in the spring of 2016. And with a swell and a romantic orchestral flourish, we end this hour noting the loss of someone who was a master of emotional musical flourishes of all kinds. James Horner, the composer behind more than 150 movie soundtracks, he was a legend. 61-year-old Horner, a trained pilot, was alone aboard a private plane when it crashed in the Los Padres National Forest north of L.A. Horner was a huge presence in Hollywood. Two of the all-time highest-grossing films, Avatar and Titanic, both Horner scores. He won 2 Oscars and said this in an interview in 2009. When we lose a character, when somebody wins, when somebody loses, when someone disappears, at all times I'm keeping track, constantly, of what the heart is supposed to be feeling. That's my primary role. That's all for today, but if you want to take the takeaway with you, subscribe to our podcast. You can find us on iTunes and take us with you on your commute home from work. Great way to stay up on the news. Again, find us on iTunes or any other service you use to get your podcasts. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With 3 updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City. By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.